Welcome to Hacking Your Leadership. I'm Chris, and welcome to today's guest interview. Our guest interviews are long-form interviews with leaders from around the world. They've each been selected because of their valuable perspective on leadership and work they've accomplished in this space. Today, we're joined by Ron Carucci, managing partner of Navalent, a consulting firm specializing in organizational transformation. He's a two-time TEDx speaker and the author of the new book, To Be Honest, Lead with the Power of Truth, Justice, and Purpose, a book that is receiving massive praise by some of the most respected names in the Fortune 500 C-suite, as well as authors, human resource professionals, and experts in psychological safety. Welcome, Ron. Say hi to our audience.
Hey, Chris. Great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me. Can't wait for a good chat.
The pleasure's all on this side of the microphone here. I want to start just by saying that I think your book should be required reading for literally anyone who leads people. It's aspirational, which makes me a little sad. And so I want to start by saying, you know, what was the impetus for writing it? You've been doing this research and you've been doing this work for many years. Was there a watershed moment or a group of little moments? Like what made you decide this has to be a book now?
You know what, Chris? I think it was a bunch of little moments. I wasn't looking to write this book, but we did the research. You know, we took a longitudinal look at 3,200 interviews across 15 years. And I wanted to understand, I mean, you know, we're all tired of the Wells Fargo, Theranos, you know.
Yes.
Volkswagen, we're tired of their stories. And I'm really tired of the explanations of, well, it's the culture, or it was a couple of bad apples. It just troubled me. Like, what would turn otherwise honest, good-hearted people into liars and cheats? And so when the research came back, we sort of, this time when we used IBM Watson, so we used really cool AI technology. And unlike our last book, we went in with a hypothesis. This time we said, okay, well, if you're intelligent technology, you tell us what we should be asking you. And so we went in and fed it all the data. And it came back with drill sites, right? So here are some things loading, correlating on each other. And one of them was the issue of honesty and truth telling and safety. I thought, huh. So we formed a couple of hypotheses to see, could we predict under what conditions people would tell the truth, behave fairly, and serve a greater good, and under what conditions they would lie, cheat, and serve their own interests first? And if we could, that would be really cool. Because if you can predict it, you can preempt it.
Sure. Replicate it.
And sure enough, the data, after lots of turns and churns and statistical modeling, came back and revealed four very provable conditions under which you could predict, with statistical factors and multipliers, the conditions under which people would, you know, do the right thing, and under which conditions they would not.
I love that. And I think I want to talk about each of those four individually, because some of them to me are like duh moments. And then some of them I think are really, really important and maybe not thought about as much in organizational leadership. And those are the ones I want to talk about even more. People think when you tell them you got to be honest, they look at it as, well, what's the opposite of that? What am I not doing there? Well, I'm not lying. It's like, well, I don't lie. It's deeper than that. It's not just not lying. You're talking about honesty as it's almost like an acknowledgement of a transparent world and just kind of knowing that nothing's going to go hidden anyway. So why even try?
Well, that you have to wonder why some people think that, you know, there's not a camera or social media watching when they do some of the dumb things they do. But you're very wise to say that it's more than just not lying. It turns out that the data, the way it came back, was sort of defining honesty in the eyes of people as sort of the combination of truth, justice, and purpose. And when you look at the neuroscience, our brains are actually wired in similar pathways for the same areas, right? So honesty, justice, and meaning all emanate from the same parts of our brain. And so the book defines honesty as all three of those things: truth, justice, purpose. You have to say the right thing, do the right thing, and say and do the right thing for the right reason. And that's the bar to which we're going to be held accountable for honesty these days, right? Because our experience, you don't have to look around too far to see how our experience of honesty has gone into a free fall, which means the bar has gone that much higher. People are going to punish leaders by expecting that much more from them just to prove table stakes of honesty. You mean, forget about becoming a paragon of virtue. Just getting to the table and being seen as honest requires all those things now.
Yeah, I love how you put it in the context of the saying the right thing and the right thing for the right reason. I think we see this a lot, and oftentimes we dismiss this when it comes to even parent. I'm a parent, and I've done this as a parent. I've seen it out of leaders. I've seen it out of politicians. I've seen it out of a lot of people where the wrong thing is said for the right reason. A very public one recently is the whole idea of, oh, you don't need masks, don't go buy masks. And it was the CDC and the World Health Organization saying, we don't want to see this public run on masks. That means our health professionals don't have access to them. And so the what's the old, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? Clearly what their intention was good. But what damage do they cause in their credibility in the long term that is more damaging than the damage that would have been caused by a run on masks for a few weeks or whatever, and then you adjust and have more production? We see that so many places. Why do you think people default to that? Almost like a patronization of who you're talking to. Oh, this person is not capable of living on this level that I'm living on, so I need to kind of treat them like a child.
Well, that's exactly the reason I think it is. People just don't think. Right. And they bet so much on their good intentions that people will see, right, sort of just presume the best of me. Well, when your actions and words don't match and you confuse people or you get media points, you get talking points, and you become a talking head rather than, looking people in the eye, treating them as human beings, trusting them with hard information and empowering them to make better choices, right? So when honesty becomes deemed that way, when I know you haven't spun something, when I know what you've told me, even if it's, I can take it if it's hard, I can take it if I don't like it, I can take it if I disagree with it. What I can take it is if you're shoving something down my throat in a way you're trying to make it palatable to me, or trying to make me able to hear it, or spinning it in a way that makes me think you think I'm a second grader. Now I'm gonna be more suspicious of you than ever, and now, even the truth you did tell me, I'm going to question.
Yeah, that's the biggest part too. Is that this isn't a one and done. Oh, now the relationship's over. Anytime you have to have an ongoing relationship with a person, now that becomes more damaging. There's a quote that I'll paraphrase that's often attributed to Mark Twain: "If you never lie, you never have to remember what you said." And I like that quote a lot because it's amazing the baggage we carry around with us when we're trying to live the lies that we tell that started out rooted in good intentions, and now they eat at us. They eat away at us. I think it actually causes illness in us when we carry around these things for a long time.
And the science to prove it is in the book, right? So with a great discovery from a scientific point of view is that our brains are actually wired for honesty. We actually, our physical health, our mental health, and our social health is actually better when we're honest. The problem is, unlike our phone devices that come with a, restore factory settings button, our brains don't. And so what we also know is that when we put our natural proclivities for honesty in a situation that doesn't match that, we will succumb. Right? And the entrance to every slippery slope is paved with the words, well, at least I'm not as bad as. And so, but though we have slippery slopes, unfortunately, we don't have slippery ascents. And so once you've succumbed and moved the line, you either have to extract yourself quickly or that line becomes your new normal. But the fact of the matter is our brains, our bodies, our physical health. There's a bunch of research in the book around the healthiest countries in the world are also the most honest countries in the world.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And it seems logical, like, because every one of us, even the most honest of us, can remember a time when we weren't honest, when we said something that was not true, and the baggage that we carried around with that, not in that we felt bad that we lied to somebody, but literally in the baggage of I'm worried about being found out, and what does this mean, and what steps do we have to take now to live this forever? And eventually it becomes you're not willing to take it anymore. Like, some people give up on the lie and they come clean for no other reason than it's like, we just can't take this anymore. It's costing us more to live it.
Well, and the thing that I want people to read, the question I'm asking readers in the book is not, do you lie? University of Massachusetts estimates that we all lie on average at least twice a day. Maybe some more. People who say they don't lie are self-deceived. The question I want people to think about is, why do you lie? Because it's not random, right? Our moments of deception are predicated on moments we don't feel safe, moments we feel invisible, moments we feel misjudged, moments we feel devalued, right? Our proclivity for deceit, whether that's spinning or hoarding or embellishing or withholding or out and out, you know, fabricating, are moments where we are intentionally meeting some need, right? So if I asked you to just examine the last 10 times you were dishonest, you treated somebody badly, you spun information, you tried to engineer a reaction to something or a perception of yourself, just examine the last 10 times and you will absolutely, if you're honest, you will see a pattern. You will see conditions, triggers, people, settings that tell you these are the moments that bring you to your deceit. So now ask yourself, did you really meet that need? Did your choice for less than honest behavior, momentarily, cover up some wound, lead you to feel some momentary sense of false confidence or discomfort? But to the point you make, Chris, but how'd you feel 20 minutes later? Because the shame, the guilt, here's the problem. We all have a need to matter. We all have a need to know that we're significant. We all have a need to know that our lives count for something. It's a natural inborn need. But when that need goes unmet, we settle for the count of it, looking like we matter. And when we work to feed the need of looking like we matter, that's when we lie. Because now, once you've created the illusion of significance, you have to keep it up. And that's exhausting. And you cannot be true to yourself until you're true about yourself.
Why do you think people put more work into looking like they matter than putting work into actually mattering? Do you think actually mattering is too difficult? Do you think they don't know where to start? What do you think it is?
Such a great question, Chris. I think it's because they don't believe they do. I think there are narratives and tapes that cause them to question that in the first place, right? Or they wind up just go back to your seventh grade gym teacher. Right. Go back to Mean Uncle Harry. Somebody set in motion a narrative that said you aren't valuable. You aren't important. You don't. Your voice doesn't count. Your work isn't worthy. And so when we have those formative narratives, we feed them. Right. They become the consonants of our life. And so you have to work to keep those narratives true. So you put yourself in situations that reinforce the fact that you don't matter. Then you get to live the lie of looking like you do. The problem is when people like that actually let that wall down and experience the genuine, authentic love and regard of others that tell them that they actually do matter, it's almost emotionally an earthquake, right? They just can't handle the actual consonance of actually mattering because they've worked so hard to live with the narrative of not mattering and creating the illusion of something different. And that takes a lot of work. It takes, you know, coaching, therapy, whatever it is. You have to actually reconstruct your self-perception to be consistent with what you want to believe about yourself. Do you want to believe you do matter, or do you want to believe you don't and look like you do?
It's interesting because I think a lot of this is subconscious too, because if you ask the average person who lives and dies by the number of likes they get on social media and the rose-colored lens they put their life through for everybody, I don't think that they would say, even if they're being truly honest, I don't think they would say that they don't think they matter and they're trying to cover it up. I think they believe they actually matter.
Well, those vanity metrics tell them they do, right? But if I were to probe a little deeper and say, when are you at your best? When in your life does your fingerprint on the world look like something you're most proud of? What's your record-setting moment of having impact? What is it you want to say on your epitaph? When you're not in the room, what do you want people who work with you to say about you? What are the stories being told about you at the dinner table at night by the people you lead? Answer those questions for me. And I'll tell you if you believe you matter or not.
I mean, it's fascinating stuff. And we've been talking a little bit on our show about the concept of legacy and about how leaving a legacy and it, you know, really puts things in a perspective of what's important and what's not important. And I think there's a lot of overlap here. There's a little Venn diagram here of legacy when it comes to honesty, because when you experience something, I'll speak for myself. When I experience something that is that makes me, you know, face my own mortality or think about, you know, kind of really that forces a reprioritization of what's in my life. Nothing that involves creating a false sense of what I am when I'm not really that or lying about things, none of that matters at all. It all just goes away. It's all honesty when you're talking about prioritizing what's truly important.
Well, and doesn't the rubber hit the road with that stage 3 diagnosis? Or yours or somebody you love, or the sorry, we no longer require your services meeting with your boss, or the that phone call in the middle of the night from your teenager, or you know, whatever the existential moment is, life has a way of completely reprioritizing in a matter of seconds. And that's when you know what your soul's made of. That's when you begin to come to understand, what have I lived for? What has mattered more to me than air? And sometimes we find out it was money. It was ambition. It was achievement. It was self-aggrandizement. You know, we may have told ourselves it was in the service of some greater aspiration, but the reality is the evidence would say in that horrible moment, it was not. What's especially true in those moments is ask yourself the question in that oh shit moment when life unravels and falls apart, how long do you have to stare at your phone before you know who to call? Because if you could, if you're like, I don't know who I'd call. If you don't, if you haven't got 30 people, you know, if you called, would be at your house on the next plane in the car in seconds, that's telling you how much you really do matter.
And I think the more you lead your life in this way, the more you lead your life with honesty at the center of what you do, I'm guessing the longer that list is for you.
Completely the truth. And that's the reason I wrote this book, Chris, is because the book is a book of heroes, right? I didn't want to write about the villains. This is a book of heroes. This is an entire array of people who do live their life this way. And the results and the impact on the world they have prove it. And what was so special for me to be in their presence was to go, wow, we can emulate this. I can replicate this in my life if I choose to. And sometimes it'll be hard, but I can. There are footsteps I can follow in by plenty of people. I don't have to make this up as I go along. I don't have to succumb to a Volkswagen situation. There are pathways well trodden of people I would be proud to be a fraction of, in how I live my life, and they've gone before me and set an example. And that was the fun part of it, is to go, I have choices here. I don't have to, you know, settle for external validation metrics or vanity metrics or an emotional roller coaster every day of wondering, why am I on the planet and does anybody else care? And we all have those moments of existential crisis of wondering, is it all worth it? The question is, who are you in that moment and who do you go to in that moment?
Yeah, I think, you know, in a lot of organizations, we talk about the importance of top down, right? Top down leadership and leadership setting the tone of the organization when it comes to stuff like this. I can tell you from personal experience, I've been in organizations where the kind of movement away from honesty is a bottom up thing. And here's what I mean by that. There's an expectation of a result of whatever the organization is. And, you know, there's gaps, there's ups and downs. And all of a sudden somebody emerges as someone who becomes really good at doing something. And instead of questioning how they got there, they prop the person up and they say, look at this, what this person's results are. And you should be like that person. And then whether or not that person did it the right way or the wrong way, there's this immense pressure for others to kind of meet that. And then they try to figure out, okay, how do I navigate these waters? And then they end up compromising their own integrity a little bit to try to not be left behind. And then what happens is it's eaten away from the bottom up. And then by the time the leadership figures out what's going on, it's like, well, now there's a decision. Do we take the bonuses we've been getting because of the work of these people that we never bothered to look into how they were actually getting what they were getting? Or do we put a stop to this and say, okay, we've just found out it was the wrong way. We need to like own it as we never looked into this and put a stop to it and know that the gravy train is going to stop at least temporarily. And these kind of moments are, I think a lot of organizations kind of, they see these moments and some of them don't do the right thing. They kind of put their head in the sand and it's plausible deniability.
If your accountability process is the way contribution is measured, lacks dignity and lacks justice, you're four times more likely to have people lie, cheat, and be self-interested. Because now I have to embellish my accomplishments. Now I've got to copy other people. Now I've got to throw people under the bus. I have to take credit for other people's work. I have to hide my mistakes. What people don't recognize is that holding up other people as examples to copy in today's world makes no sense. When we were all being measured on replicable work, repeatable things, how many t-shirts did you make today? It was fine. And that's the era our systems were designed for. Today, as knowledge workers, my remit is as personal as I am. It's my analysis, my creativity, my idea, my radical thought, my dissent, my solution. my passion, the things that caused me to have impact, you know, today the contribution and the contributor are much more fused than ever. So trying to treat everybody the same is actually what makes it unfair. You know, today managers have a much higher bar of holding people accountable because everybody is unique and different, right? So trying to hold up one yardstick as a ubiquitous set of metrics for everybody is exactly what makes accountability unfair and undignifying. The process that should be the most honoring and dignifying experience in our companies has become the most demeaning and demoralizing precisely because it treats everybody the same and creates this false rank comparison among people and stack ranks people. And you know, people experience it as offensive. I had one coaching guy, an executive, a really talented guy that I work with regularly. And he showed up to our normal routine coaching session. You know, and as soon as he came on screen, I could see it, like his neck was red and like his face was, and I knew he was coming out of his performance review that morning with his executive leader. And he started pounding the table. You know, she gave me a 3. Are you kidding me? I'm always a 4. In my last company, I was a 5. And just because HR now gives her a quota of how many 4 she can give out, I got the 3. Who the hell got the 4? Like he was, I mean, irrationally irate. And it took me 2 hours to back him off the ledge. And I asked him to forward me send me the forms. I want to read them. And as I'm reading through the content of the words, I'm like, this is reasonable. She was very affirming of his work, very caring of his contributions and appreciative of that. And the places where she wrote that where he needed to be better were accurate. He'd been the number one candidate for a succession job for, you know, to move up in the next 12 to 18 months. He was still that candidate. Nothing had changed. But the number 3 set him to the brink of irrational, like, you know, contempt. Turns out it's actually very explainable. When we are, as humans, when we're categorized, our amygdala is triggered, right? Our flight or fight mechanism is threatened. We literally perceive a categorization as feeling invisible, feeling unsafe, and feeling misjudged. It doesn't even matter what the category is. If he'd been a 4, he would have wanted it higher. So even if you're labeled correctly, we do not like being categorized, and our natural response is threat and protection. So our systems are built to put people into boxes that cause them to be their worst rather than invite them to be their best. So our accountability systems have got to change and adjust if we're ever going to not have the scenario you described where, you know, I hold up some paragon of virtue because I want to clone them, and everybody, and then I get what I wish. I get a bunch of clones, except I got it, you know, through a corrupt means.
Everything you're saying makes perfect sense, but I'm struggling to think about what that looks like. How, you know, I'm just, especially when you have situations where you have people doing the same job. You know, if every job was different, even slightly, then that's great, you know. But there are a lot of jobs out there where there is redundancy. You have teams of 50 people or 100 people or 10 people where they all are doing 99% of the same work because that's the work that has to get done. You know, if you want to recognize performance without creating this, you know, feeling amongst people who weren't number 1 or number 2 that, oh my gosh, this is all that matters. You know, how do you continue to, you know, how does a meritocracy continue? Or are you talking about it not being a meritocracy?
Let's take a team of engineers all doing coding work, team of 30 engineers. First of all, don't have a system that ranks people, right? Because you cannot tell me every one of those coders is equally the same. You cannot tell me that each one of their work. So hold them accountable to what you've asked them to commit to, not to compare them to each other. You know, don't have bonus and reward systems. And by the way, the issue in accountability is not the rewards. People are not off-put by the rewards. When they sense unfairness, it's whether or not the rewards were adjudicated fairly against performance, right? I don't care about the money, but if you're telling me this is the yardstick and he's it and I'm not, now I'm going to all produce you a mound of evidence that I am. Simply hold people accountable individually or better as a team, right? So if they're working in coding teams of 8 engineers, hold the 8 of them accountable to the same thing, reward them the same way. And make your evaluation an honor of their work, understanding that even if they were all coding the exact same code, which they probably were not, right? But it's still a reflection of them. Coding is still, it's art and science. So hold them accountable to the unique things they brought to that work. Appreciate that. Ask them what was meaningful. Here's a simple one. I tell leaders it's one of the most underutilized ways of appreciating people's work. Ask for the story. Sit down with an engineer and say, wow, I haven't coded in years since I took a supervisor job. I have no idea, but I'll bet that those 100 lines of code where you sweat bullets for it. Tell me how you did it. And just listen to the story. And watch them become animated and vulnerable and intensified and excited and frustrated. And they'll tell you what they learned and tell you what was hard. And they'll tell you what they were excited about, where they were proud, where they struggled, and where they broke through. That 15 minutes of just holding that story is one of the most honoring things you can do. That's better than any form you can fill out. Just honor the stories. And if you ask every one of those coders, you're going to get a different story because they're different people, right? So using the excuse that all the work is the same to treat all the people the same is just bullshit. It's just lazy. But you're just basically being lazy. Now, will you train that way for your performance management system to do that? Sure. Untrain yourself. Because that training was good in 1980, but it's not good now. So work harder at it. If you have to work harder at holding people accountable, at the core of accountability has to be a very intimate and trusting relationship between a leader and a follower. If you're not good at that, get better at it.
One of my mentors has always said, and he stands by this to this day, he said, a good performance review can happen on the back of a napkin. He said the format doesn't matter if the relationship is there.
And if the relationship's not there, you need the forms, you need all the stuff. Do you ever see anybody come out of the room going, wow, I love my performance appraisal? No, it's insufferable. People lose sleep, they get anxious, they have to take pills, they drink heavily. Like, it's why? Why is the moment where my work goes on display that should be the most exciting, honoring, dignifying, proud moment of the year? Why has it become like I'd rather have root canal?
And then organizations go through the process every 1 to 5 years of revamping that form to fill in the gaps where the leadership doesn't exist to create those relationships. So they try to say, well, we're not going to expect people to actually have relationships with their people. We're going to give them a form that, as long as they adhere to the form, it will create the illusion of the relationship.
Worse than that, Chris, it will create the illusion that we've neutralized the variance in their in the treatment. All it does is neutralize the variance in your stupidity, right? So what have many companies done? They got rid of the forms. But now people are rudderless, right? So we went to monthly check-ins. People still need feedback. People want to be held accountable. They want to be told where they're falling short. They want to know you're on their side to help them get better. They want to know that you're their ally in the process of improving. They want to know that you're on their side and that you'll give them the resources and coaching and mentoring they need to advance. They don't give a shit about what you write down. And the ones I hate the most, Chris, are the ones where the boss says, you fill out the form and I'll sign it. And then I'll give you a few thoughts. And then if you wouldn't mind, drop it off at HR for me.
For sure. I like that you characterized laziness in there for a minute. You said that it's that they're lazy. I heard somebody say once that people aren't bad, they're lazy. And I took offense to that for just a moment. I thought, well, he kind of meant it as a kind of a clickbaity phrase. But what he really means is that, on a long enough timeline, nobody can maintain whatever these high standards are on their own without being involved in a group that will hold them up to those standards as well. You can't work 5 times harder than everybody else around you for 10 years straight. You can do it. Some people have their breaking point further down the road than others, but eventually your standards will start to slip to meet the standards of whatever the group is. And I think that has a lot to do with what you're talking about in terms of the degradation of the honesty of an organization.
My decision to use my discretionary energy to reach beyond my limits or to reach for something that's going to be hard, to take a risk for you, to sacrifice for you, will be directly predicated on, will you be there to support me? Will there be a safety net? Will you cheer me on? Will I get the resources to do it? Will my team celebrate it with me? Can I get help? It's not going to be based on whatever carrot you hold out for me. It's not going to be based on whatever rating I think is waiting for me there. And so if you haven't created the conditions under which you'll get that extra measure of performance, you'll get that extra measure of push, not because you held a line out there, but because you set the conditions under which people want to excel. People want to find their own limits. They want to realize the edges of their potential, and they want you to go with them. And if you create the invitation where people can go with you, you'll go with them, they'll do it. And if you create the conditions under which people believe it's not safe to do that, they'll get hurt, you'll hang them out to dry, or you'll throw them under the bus if things don't go well, forget it. They're going to do what's safe.
Yeah. I want to dig into the four factors that you talk about in your book, and I'll kind of list them off real quickly for our listeners here. We have clear identity, accountability, governance, and cross-functional relationships. And I want to talk about how each of these matter individually. But first, I want to give it up to a word from a sponsor. All right, we're here with Ron Carucci, and I just asked him right before that ad break there to talk about the four factors in his new book, To Be Honest, clear identity, accountability, governance, and cross-functional relationships. The first one, clear identity, you know, I had a mentor of mine say once a long time ago that the first things that she starts every single career conversation with anybody with is two questions. Do you know why this organization exists on the planet, A, and B, are you excited by that? Talk about why it's important to have a clear identity of who you are as an organization.
First of all, I love the question she asks. I hope there's actually an answer to it, right? I hope the organization knows the answer to the question, because here's the problem. If there is an answer and the experience of employees is not consistent with the answer, you got a problem. But having a real purpose, all of our organizations have words that describe who they are, their intent to be. And those words are not just, you know, they have to be more than media or for advertising consumption. They have to be promises, right? Your values, your mission, your purpose, your vision, whatever you've chosen to codify it in. People have to be expected to align their choices to that. And so what we found is if the employees and your customers' experience of those words is consistent with your actions, you are being who you say you are, you are three times more likely to have people tell the truth, behave fairly, and serve a greater good. But if those words exist on a wall, a screensaver, the t-shirts, the mouse pads, whatever you put them on, and they're nothing but a campaign, but what people actually do in lived experience is quite different, what you've now done is institutionalized duplicity. You've now said to your organization, hey, just so you know, around here, we say one thing, but we do another. And so you have permission to do the same thing. And so people, if they hear your values stated, or they hear a speech about your mission, or they hear your newly crafted, beautiful, glossy purpose statement developed by your marketing department, and all they do is roll their eyes, they're conveying to you, they don't believe you, and they'll go right on being duplicitous. Now you're three times more likely to have people lie, cheat, and serve their own interests first. So you'd be better off saying nothing about yourself, having no purpose. And there's actually research in the book that shows people can take that. People can take you saying, we're here to make money, that's it. And you won't have a loss. What they can take is you saying one thing and doing another, right? So if you declare a purpose statement and don't live it, they'll crucify you for it.
You have to believe it yourself too, by the way. Like even if the person, I'm saying the person saying it has to believe it too. I know of situations where I've been in personally where I believe the senior leaders of an organization believe something that is righteous and noble, but the person in middle management who is delivering the message to me doesn't believe it themselves, but they're saying it anyway, and I'm still not bought in, even though I can articulate that I know that their bosses believe it.
Well, and the reality, and if there's no accountability for that middle manager to embody that purpose with their behavior and actions, it may not have captivated their heart to the deepest levels, but if it's cosmetic and you're just a parrot, you are diluting the resources of the organization. You are diluting the fabric of the culture by telling people, yeah, this is a top-down cascade. This is the message. Do what you want with it. Well, then why have the statement, right? If you don't intend to make those promises personal to every employee, then don't make them.
It's tough because like a lot of organizations, they gravitate towards these kind of vision statements and mission statements and purpose statements that are small enough to fit on the mouse pad or the wall or the, you know, whatever it is. And I think the smaller and more easily digestible they are, the more ambiguous and kind of they contain within them the ability to shoehorn whatever actions you're doing into that. You know, like if that's your North Star, but it's vague, then you can say, well, what I'm doing, you know, yeah, of course that's what I'm doing, you know. You know, there are other companies where their statements are paragraphs long, hundreds of words that are kind of like the governing statements of the organization. It's a lot harder to shoehorn something you want to do into that and be honest with yourself if it doesn't really work.
And it was so funny. Whenever I Most of the time when executives call me in to help them develop that framework, I usually will say no. Because what I'll say is, let's figure out what it ought to be and have you live it for a year and earn your right to write it down. And only the clients that will hire me are serious. But when I hear the words, oh, it's too many words, it's not memorable. I'm like, is it based, are you gonna give a quiz? Like, why do you care if they can recite it? I only care if they can live it. And so I don't really care how many words it is. If you're looking at people to be kitschy and fit on a mouse pad or fit the marketing campaign, let's admit right now, it's cosmetic. This is meant for external consumption only. You don't actually care about embedding it, because what most people think is that the journey of codification of your aspirations or your behaviors is the end of a journey. That's just the start. Right? The minute you codify those values or that purpose or that mission, you have handed your employees a weapon, and they will weaponize it. They'll weaponize it against you. They'll hold that yard stick up and beat you with it and use your hypocrisy as justification for why they don't have to try. So you'd be better off not developing the statements unless you're serious about putting them in your selection systems, your reward systems, your development systems, your budgeting systems, your governance processes, and making sure it is a personal matter for every employee and there's regular feedback. They get to talk about whether or not they're experiencing those things and tell you when you're falling short. If that is not your intention, do not write them down, because you know why? Everybody knows today that we're all purpose washing, right? We're all, every brand in the world is trying to, you know, and every marketer in the world is trying to make it look like their brand stands for something more than just the product. Well, I thought all the research is in the book. Consumers see right through it. They will bring their dollars and their loyalty to the brands they believe actually stand for a purpose that they care about, but they will not tolerate it if it's fake, and they'll walk right away from you the minute you fall short.
Yeah, I think we all can relate to the moment we make a personal declaration, you know, the New Year's resolution on January 1st, I'm going to lose weight this month or this year, I'm going to read a book every week this year, all those things. And I think those can be very, very effective to make those declarations before we know we can do it, as a way to hold ourselves accountable. Like, we've declared this to our friends and our, you know, but we can't apply that to something where there is like 30 layers in an organization, because now you're in essence declaring it for a lot of other people who may not have bought into that yet or know that it exists. And the people who have to execute are going to hold you accountable to their actions in the middle too. So, I mean, it really only works if it's about you personally, what you're going to do, but not what your whole organization's going to do.
One of the many stories I tell in the book in this section is a Best Buy. Right, what Obeir's incredible turnaround at Best Buy, what he did was, before writing down their purpose of enriching lives through technology, he went out and listened to thousands of employees in the stores and asked the question, when are we at our best? What does it look like? What is the purpose you are serving in your life? How can we help you do that? Right. And so crafted that purpose from the ground up and brought it out of the hearts and minds of his employees, which is why they live it. Right. Satya Nadella, when he took over being CEO of Microsoft, took his whole team off site. They sat on couches and beanbags, not around a table. And he said to them, we're going to flip the script here. Microsoft works for you. How will Microsoft be a platform for you to live out your purpose in the world? How can we support you and why you're here? What is the fingerprint you want to leave on the world? And how will Microsoft help you do it? And that is how he's embedding purpose down through the entire organization of every Microsoft employee. So if you're willing to embed purpose and invite a sense of joining my story to a bigger story, you can get it. If it's a cosmetic thing you declare and you hope somebody latches onto it, you're just setting the whole organization up to fail, because half of them aren't going to.
And now you have no credibility to do a do-over. Later on, you can't go, oh yeah, you know what? We put the cart before the horse, everybody. We're going to take a step back and do our due diligence this time. You've already lost the trust.
No, this time I mean it is not a thing.
Absolutely. The next factor here is accountability. I wrote down a note here when I went next to the word accountability here, others, not me. You know, I receive the accountability that I need. The problem is the others on my team do not receive the accountability that they need. And in my consulting practice, I administer an engagement survey. And one of the outlier questions, and it really doesn't matter to the organization, the question that will get a slightly or significantly lower score than others that are related to it is, my coworkers and peers are committed to doing quality work. You know, everybody says they're committed to doing quality work, but my coworkers not necessarily. Why do you think it is that accountability is a four-letter word for ourselves, but not for our peers?
Fewer words induce a tighter wince than that word. And so it goes back to everything we talked about before about dignity and justice, right? So if the process by which contributions are talked about is undignifying, and it's a comparatively rivalrous environment where I'm going to downgrade my colleagues because I think, you know, I should be the standard, then your culture has said accountability is a dog eat dog zero sum game, right? So we're being stack ranked and we're being compared. And so to self-soothe my own sense of purpose or my own sense of significance, I will just throw my colleagues under the bus, right? So, you know, forget about teamwork in that environment. There'll be no collaboration. But we all want to believe that we're paragons of performance. And the only way to make sure we feel that way is to talk about our employees or our colleagues that aren't. Now, here's the thing. If your culture is one where leaders are conflict averse, where a healthy degree of ongoing feedback is not offered, right? And there is a complete, you know, loser on my team who is dragging the team down, isn't held accountable for their poor work, makes the team do double duty to try and keep up with them. We have to cover for their mistakes. And that's going unaddressed. I have to conclude they know about it. They don't care. Ergo, it's on my back that the rest of his team is performing, right? So now you've created this Darwinian environment where I have to make everybody else feel bad for me to feel good. So that's a classic symptom, Chris, of an environment where people are not, there's no feedback. Because if there's a dud on my team, why isn't the entire team saying, hey, dude, pull your weight? Or, hey, around, just so you know, around here, we don't do that. If people aren't, if you know, they're all talking about it in the hallway or over the urinal about that person. But if that person's not being told how to get better or where they're falling short, they probably have no clue. And that's an environment rife for a scandal, for a lawsuit, for somebody saying the wrong thing, because you've now made accountability very unjust and very undignified.
Yeah, I see two things that kind of that kind of hurt this effort. There's a tremendous push for psychological safety in the workplace now, and a lot of leaders, they think that what psychological safety means is that no one should ever feel uncomfortable. And if people have even visibility to the results of their teammates, then the one who's bringing up the rear is going to feel bad that they are bringing up the rear. And you know, my take has always been, well, how about we just hold people accountable who would look at that scorecard or those numbers and then go to that person and say, what the hell are you thinking, idiot? And say, that person can't be on my team anymore because you treated a coworker that way, as opposed to saying, let's hide all the results and then hope people get there. How about we hoist people up who can look at those numbers and go, oh, this thing that my coworker's not good at, I'm really good at, but I'm also looking at the scorecard and they're really good at something that I struggle with. Let me just go work with them and we can both solve each other's problems together. You lose all of that when you remove the ability for people to see what their coworkers are doing.
First of all, as if they don't already know. Not seeing the actual data doesn't mean they're not aware. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of, Amy Edmondson was one of my interviewees for the book, and we talked a lot about many of the misconceptions about psychological safety. Certainly people, you know, that it's a coddling. People feel comfortable or people feel like it's a safe place to sort of vent and whine. It's none of those things at all. Psychological safety is actually very hard because it sort of goes into the governance question, where if you have not got open dissent, if you haven't got a safe place to share dangerous truths, and it's all going underground, you as a leader have to, know that you're just inserting risk into the organization and to your team. It's a very simple litmus test you have to ask yourself. If you don't have somebody coming into your office as their boss once or twice a week and saying something that's uncomfortable for you to hear, be very confident your leadership sucks.
Yeah, I love that. I want to talk about governance too, because it's so important. There's the movie trope of the, oh, why they were murdered because they knew the thing, the whistleblower knew the thing and no one wanted to let it out. But in actuality, it happens in much smaller, ways. all over the workforce. We see it when it hits the headlines, like in Wells Fargo and Volkswagen, but it happens in little ways all over the place, and it slowly erodes the relationships and the trust. What can individual people do when it comes to governance if they're not part of the C-suite, if they're just trying to make sure that things go well in their silo?
Governance is organization-wide, right? If you go to meetings, you're part of governance, right? Every gathering that you sit in, where people are there presumably to solve a problem or make a decision, there's some presumed set of resources or authority allocated to that room to solve that problem or advance that strategy. That's governance, right? So here's the two factors. If you walk into that room and A, you can trust that the data being presented is honest and credible and complete, and you believe that it's perfectly okay for you to offer a point of view on that data, or to push back on a decision, or to question the validity of some remark, or to be concerned about the soundness of a choice. And that's expected of you to improve the quality of the outcome. Your governance is fine. But if you walk into that room and it's orchestrated theater, nothing but performance art, the data has been spun and scrubbed, it's not telling the whole story, you know where the real data is and it's not in the room, and you know the last thing that's expected or wanted of you is for you to raise a concern or a question or to push back on prevailing thinking or to even dissent, then your governance is now corrupted. And so now I have to go to the underground to get real data. I have to sort of back channel any concerns or decide not worth trying and let the thing blow up, right? When that's the case, you're 3.5 times likely to have people lie and cheat. Because now I have to cover up my mistakes, I have to point fingers, I have to throw my colleagues under the bus, and I have to then claim later, I didn't see it coming. So it's hard, but it's not complicated. What people are gathering around what tables, for what reasons in your organization, and what is it they believe they're there to do? And if you have people who are saying things like, oh my God, I spent all my time in meetings and a waste of my time. Or they're saying things like, wow, the reason I love going to meetings is so I can catch up on my email. Or, why the 50 people in the room? It's a waste of time. Or it's your quarterly business review and the person up in front of the room is presenting their forecast for the next quarter. And everybody in the room is thinking, this is such bullshit. But the closest thing you get to a statement is, wow, Bill, interesting forecast. Which everybody knows what's code for, but that's the closest you get, your governance is corrupt. If you have not created the conditions under which people are bringing you the hard news, the interesting news, the creative news, the challenging news, no matter what you say, you can say to your blue in the face, of course I want pushback. Of course I want people dissenting. I want creative ideas. But you've not created the room that can hold it and not given people the skills to do it, then your promise is and your declaration of wanting it is empty.
I think there are a lot of rooms out there where if it works already, it's almost self-sustaining, because if a person's about to go into the room to give the quarterly business review and they know that the organization has great governance, they're less likely to get up there with something they know is going to get picked apart and be told this is ridiculous. They're going to come in with something that is more honest and transparent and rooted in something real. But there are a lot of places out there where they're already in this rabbit hole. They're in this place where this is the theater that happens, and any efforts by anybody to kind of get out of that is looked at even by peers as, wow, why are we so hard on Bill? You know, why even, you know? And it's like, well, no, I wasn't trying to be hard on Bill. I was just really, I was calling to mind. And the people saying, why are you being so hard on Bill? We're thinking the same thing that you said to Bill. They just didn't say it themselves. You know, how can organizations break this cycle? Because once I think they're in a good rhythm, I think it will, you know, it's easier to keep than it is to get.
So I had a CEO client that did this really well with his executive team. He started with a couple of practices. First of all, he made round robin feedback a regular part of the team meeting. So every couple of months, they do speed dating with each other in quick rounds. And it was a, hey, Chris, here's something I really appreciate about you. Hey, Chris, here's one thing I'd love to see you improve. Here's one thing I need from you to be a better teammate. Ding, 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 ding. And so the exchange of hard personal information was a normal practice. Secondly, when they were making a major decision strategically, whoever was going to be presenting on the strategy, he had assigned two other people to say, okay, you bring the dueling fact bases. You bring in the conflicting data, the contradictions to their data set, and let's duke it out in the room. He would also ask, when he'd have a point of view, he'd say, here's my point of view. Where am I out to lunch? Throw darts. And he would literally create dart throwing for ideas. And he'd model it. And the rules were no defensiveness, and people had to get the skill, right? Like, he didn't want to hear people saying to each other, are you a freaking moron? Like, what the hell's wrong with you? Like, you had to do it constructively, and they worked on the skills to do it constructively. He didn't want long windups and pull punches and, well, maybe it's me, just say it. But people had to learn. But it became routine practice, and then they were expected to cascade it. So any leader, if you're sitting around a table, if you host a meeting, you can build into that practice the ability to invite dissent, to bring creative ideas, to make it safe for people to say hard things, to make it safe for people to say hard things to you. You just have to want it. Declaring it isn't the same as wanting it. It's just a cosmetic campaign. You actually have to embody it and model it.
Yeah. The last factor here, cross-functional relationships, is probably the most near and dear to my heart, based on the work that I do. The single note that I have written next to that phrase is assuming positive intent. And when I look at the organizations that I consult with, where there are no strong cross-functional relationships, there is a severe lack of assuming positive intent. And that makes sense. You know, people don't know what other people do unless they know what other people do. And if you don't have a relationship, by definition, you know, it's not everybody's job to do everybody's job. You have to have a job, and other people in your organization have their jobs. But if you don't have at least a relationship with them, then you don't assume positive intent. And then when they do something that doesn't make sense to you, you assume negative intent. And it just eats away at the organization from the inside out. And so I want to talk about how does this matter when it comes to being honest?
Oh my gosh. So when you fragment the organization, you fragment the truth, right? So here's the thing that was probably the most surprising about this one, Chris. It's the largest factor of all four. Right. When you have cross-functional rivalry, when those seams of the organization are not stitched, and there are either broken relationships, broken trust, as you describe, or I've actually structured rivalry. Right. Your group's measured on traffic. My group's measured on conversion. Right. We could collaborate really well, or we're going to fight. Right. But now you've designed it so we can collaborate. Right. If that's the case, you are 6 times more likely to have people lie and cheat and be self-interested, because now it's no longer about a single source of truth. It's about my truth versus your truth. And the only thing I care about is being right and you wrong. So if you want those seams to be cohesive, if you want bridges built across those seams, you have to design them to be that way. Right. So and there isn't any piece of work that your organization does to contribute to its competitive value that's done in one group. There's no single competitive capability you have that isn't a combination of multiple factors, right? So if you're competing on innovation, your customer analytics, your R&D, and your marketing group are the sum total of innovation, right? Maybe a product development group. If you're competing on service, your sales group, your supply chain, and your customer analytics group, and your customer service department better be a great quartet. Right. That's the capability you're leaning toward. Do you think if the four of them don't see it that way, then they look at each other as a pain in the neck. Right. I have to get this report done. What do you want? Well, I need the data. Well, you can have it next week. I need it today. If those conversations are happening, that's just telling you that you've got silos that are, and the tribalism that comes with silos that are overarching the greater good. Right. If people don't understand the bigger story that they're part of, they will default to the story of their own tribe.
100%. My career experience is in a lot of retail organizations. And one of the largest gaps that I've seen is the lack of cross-functional relationship between home office employees and field employees when in retail organizations. It's just almost, it's terrible. It's the worst. Even in companies who do it well, it's not very good. And I remember having this thing when I was a store manager. I remember having this kind of thing that went around with store managers, that if a memo went out to the home office people that said all hundreds of stores were closing permanently, the response would be, thank God, now we get some work done, you know? And it was very easy to laugh about that. And then when I transitioned into a role in the home office, I remember being in rooms with people who were, you know, kind of pulling their hair out at, why can't these people just execute the thing that we put out? Why can't they? And it's like, and I remember being in situations where we were expected to kind of steer this massive ship because somebody said this is the new thing. It's like, well, just saying this is the new thing, there's no if you build it, they will come. This takes time. You have to. You're talking about thousands of people. This isn't a knee-jerk reaction here. And even if where it is, it's not well done. To be done well, it's done methodically. This is like kind of like the root of everything that I've put effort in my career, basically, is trying to strengthen the cross-functional relationship between retail employees and home office employees. How can we do this better?
So especially in retail, when you have a very federalist model, right? So I did a bunch of work many years ago with a very, very large multi-brand retailer whose headquarters was such a nagging nuisance to the stores. We redesigned it so it was only value-added activities, right? So you have to understand what is the value of that centralized set of capabilities versus the regions versus the stores. And if you have not designed your organization for your headquarters to be a value-adding machine, then and all they do is ask for reports, ask for data, and your headquarters shouldn't be asking for anything, period. Whether it's a retail environment or a multi-channel environment or a distributed network of services, they shouldn't be asking for anything. They should be there to serve, right? If the people out there in the field are the people touching your customers, driving your revenue, representing your brands, delivering your services, then that's who they should serve. So if you have it backwards and you're calling everybody to ask for reports, you're doing secret inspections, you're barraging them with training programs. One of the things Hubert Joly first did when Best Buy, right? He gets out, he's visiting hundreds of stores, and he hears, Hubert, I have 50 KPIs. I can't do it. All they do is ask me for stuff. That was done, that was stripped out in a month, right? He flipped the script so that the stores where the magic happened, and he uses the word magic, was what this was about. So if your epicenter, if your center of gravity is the ivory tower, you just take a match to it now. Whether it's retail food, I've seen it in that environment as well, retail apparel, retail anything, or it's a distributed network of services, or it's a distributed network of franchises, your center hub primary focus should be to serve. You should need to be much more concerned about the horizontal relationships across groups. Retail, merchandising, and product, right? It's the classic trench warfare, especially in apparel. It's like marketing and sales. You need to make sure that's working. If you're so focused on the vertical relationships between headquarters, regions, districts, and individual outlets, and you have that screwed up, forget about product design, logistics, buyers, and marketing. You'll never get that right.
Yeah. Ron, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Give our audience an ask. Is there a link we can include in the podcast description of the best place to go buy the book? Is there a place they can reach out to you if they want to know more or connect with you?
Love to keep in touch with your folks. So first of all, go Amazon, you can find the book there. If you want to know more about the book itself, we have a whole TV series. We did a whole news magazine show called Moments of Truth, where you get to meet backstage the heroes that I talk to in great, incredible interviews with them at tobehonest.net. You can find all the episodes there and all the videos there. Come visit us at navalent.com. If you want to find our eBooks and our articles and our videos, we've got incredible content if you want to become a better leader or a better team. And please follow me on LinkedIn. And please, if you buy the book, please leave an Amazon review. I don't even care if it's a bad one, but Amazon reviews are a big help at this point in the book's launch. So thanks for that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. We'll leave links to both the Amazon, to the book, to Navalent, and also to the series with the leaders that you spoke to for the book. Again, thank you so much for your time. I know our audience got a lot out of it, and I hope our relationship can continue. We can talk again in the future.
Chris, a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.